This is producer Joey Hambrick. Before we get into the ridiculous movie that we have to talk about today, I just want to say that we're nominated for a Rondo Award, which is a big honor. We're nominated for Best Multimedia Podcast or Streaming. You can just go to rondoaward.com to vote. Michael's collaboration with Georgie Turner, The Hounds of Xeroth, is also nominated for Best Book. And The Music of Forgotten Horrors Volume 3 is nominated for Best CD. The voting ends April 19th, so get on the ball and help us. We encourage you to head over to Rondo, once again, rondoaward.com and vote. Even though there are quite a few categories, you can only have to vote on the ones that interest you. It's easy to do, and we are so grateful for your support and help. Thank you.
Why not try to find the tiny spark of life that gives these long-dead creatures their energy? The brute force they could summon with it was awesome to behold. If one could isolate this spark and give it to a live human, it would give great strength, long life, and good health. The problem, then, was to isolate this motive power, apply it to a dead person, study it, and give the results to the world. Let me tell you the story of the Monster Ray.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you very much, Michael H. Price. I appreciate the introduction, and I want to introduce you as the author of a very many things, including some things we'll be talking about at the end of the broadcast.
Oh, yeah.
And many forgotten horrors that you can find in the world's largest bookstore, Amazon.com, and many other outlets, right?
All over the place.
That's right. And we're so happy. Also, we want to welcome people who may be coming in for the first time. Joey Hambrick, our producer, is also putting together our Facebook group, and we have people joining that all the time. It's free. You can do it. Everything's free, and except for the books, and we hope that if you become sated with the free things, then you'll want to continue with the costly things.
Yes.
We're talking about a film that I saw afresh with Joey and his girlfriend Emily about 2 weeks ago, and it is really something, isn't it?
did you have to make apologies for the screening? That's all I want to know.
Well, we did have some dazed looks, I think, mm-hmm. when it was over. And, you know, David L. Hewitt made this film, and the film we're talking about is Gallery of Terrors, I'm sorry, which was also called, now you saw it at the theater, and so I believe it was called Dr. Terror's Gallery.
A blatant Horrors. Attempt by David Hewitt, the director, to cash in on a very successful British film called Dr. Terror's House of Horrors,
right.
Which has an interesting backstory in itself, because the people who ran Amicus Pictures, the British studio, also had in the 40s, assembled a kind of a patchwork film called Dr. Terror's House of Horrors from a number of silent and early talkies. That's where they got the title. I mean, they had launched the title long before the heyday of Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a bankable title, and this thing that Hewitt put together was indeed an anthology film comprising a number of short stories.
Just like the one from Amicus.
Just like the one from Amicus Pictures, which which is, needless to say, the superior film. But, you know, when did that stop the exploitation crowd?
Exactly. And I think it's very interesting. You know, people talk about Chaney toward the end of his life and how how bad he looked. He actually doesn't look too bad in this picture, and neither does John Carradine. If you can resist the impulse to jump on the screen and straighten his tie when he's in between. But there's five big stories in Gallery. What do we call it? Gallery of Horrors.
Gallery of Horrors.
Or Dr. Terror's Gallery.
You know, it's like, what are you going to call it? Well, it's that picture that David Hewitt did before he realized his truer calling was in big-time special effects.
And which, you know, I looked into my my files, and I actually interviewed David Hewitt back, gosh, I don't know when it was. I was looking here to see if I could find it, but it was for Fangoria. And it was when he was working on that film, and I believe it was a shot in Texas film with Deborah Winters called The Outing?
Yes. A nice little spooker.
A genie in a bottle kind of gone awry, as mm-hmm, I would call it.
Mm-hmm. Very much a kid picture. Mm-hmm. In the vein of the Goonies, Ghoulies, what have you, that were all over the map in that period, and it's like, yeah, let's start another teenage horror craze like proliferated during the later 70s, 1950s. Mm-hmm. And he did some splendid opticals. The Outing has that. You can't say that about The Mighty Gorga.
No, or Wizard of Mars.
No, but Hewitt surprisingly went on to many optical effects triumphs, including a really good filming in as recently as 2002 of Graham Greene's The Quiet American with Michael Caine.
Mm-hmm. Now, also, we should talk about Russ Jones, who supplies the original stories and actually acts in the film a couple of times. Because one of the actors didn't show up, so he ends up taking on a couple of roles. But, you know, Russ Jones, for those of us who are of the Monster Bopper era, will be remembered for doing those. I think he did both of those things, didn't he, for Warren, the Mole People, and Horror of Party Beach, where he kind of did Fumetti and took the
stills, assembled the photographs from the film with comic book captions.
Right, and that was both of those were Russ Jones, were they?
Yes, and of course he was the publisher of a really good magazine called Monster Mania.
Monster Mania, yes. Then I understand he went off after that with a British producer and worked with him for a while. Do you know anything about that?
I don't have a good file on his later work.
Well, I've got my notes if I can find the name of the fellow, Anthony Nelson Keyes.
Okay, yes, of course.
The guy, he didn't work for Hammer, as I recall, but he did several horror films and other films, and I understand that's where that Russ Jones went. Now he's on the web now. He does e-books. He has recreated Monster Mania, apparently, for the internet, which I've not seen.
I'll have to catch up. Yeah, his work with Keyes was more along the lines of Script Doctor.
Yes, that's what I understand. He's an interesting character, and these are interesting stories because it's an approach that sort of predates Creepshow. These are very comic booky transitions.
Oh yeah. It feels a lot like a comic book brought to life, and of course the writing is not the most compelling that one could hope to find, but it has that spirit of trying to be really entertaining.
Yes, it does, and it's a kind of an innocent spirit almost, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like, okay, we're going to set you up and then zing you with a surprise ending. Of course, the weakness here is that the surprise endings, for the most part, aren't all that surprising.
No, and
he deals with the same kind of familiar devices that say, well, the Warren magazines, for example,
yes,
like Creepy,
yes,
we're dealing with the zombie, apparent vampire,
mm-hmm,
witches, and a very, very similar story to another Lon Chaney film, Indestructible Man.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Which is in its way then also like an earlier Lon Chaney, Man-Made Monster.
Man-Made Monster, yeah.
Universal. Well, I remember when I did three stories in the early 1970s before Uncle Sam called me overseas. I did three stories, wrote three stories for Erie, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting a script guide from Archie Goodwin, who was editing at that time.
Oh, dear old Archie.
God bless him. And he was warning against specifically a couple of the endings that we see in this picture.
Mm-hmm.
Because by that time, the early 70s, they were already cliches.
Yeah.
The stories themselves, which I think Russ Jones is responsible for, the stories themselves, you know, in an outline don't seem so bad, but the execution is sort of faulty.
Well, Hewitt was not particularly adept at screenwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And he took Jones's prose stories and developed them into a screenplay, which often feels like they're making things up as they went along.
It does, and especially John Carradine's connective material.
Mm-hmm.
I've watched that a couple of times, and I have no idea what he's talking about.
They should have just turned him loose and let him ad-lib like he did in that really neat documentary Carradine did called The Best of Sex and Violence.
Yes, with all the trailers in it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's like
he's not bad in it.
Oh, dear, no. Carradine could do no wrong. Anytime anybody has an opportunity to watch John Carradine, I don't care if it's The Wizard of Mars,
mm-hmm.
you know, watch
another David L. Hewitt film.
Another Hewitt film. It wasn't easy to get Carradine unless you hit him on the right day at the right time. And what he did with these episodes of slumming, mm-hmm. between big pictures was to take these chump change paydays and channel all his proceeds back into his Shakespeare project.
Right, which was chronically in need of financing.
Constantly in need of financing, and it really was so expensive because he would underwrite these programs for small towns throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd go to Clovis, New Mexico, which is where I met him. He'd go towns you wouldn't think a top of the line character actor would be caught dead in working. And his whole point was to bring Shakespeare to the provinces.
Yes.
And so he humbled himself with pictures like this Gallery of Horrors.
And, you know, didn't he do that, Michael, for a long time? I seem to remember that when he started doing, like, the monogram stuff, like Voodoo Man and that sort of thing, some of the people, even when he was married, and I can't remember who he was married to, but she was a co-star of his in Bluebeard for PRC, and he was even doing it at that time, as I recall, in the, like, 45, 46.
Oh, yeah. Carradine was a fascinating guy. He was a fine portraitist. A great actor of sensitive depth, also a great actor of you know, slicing the ham thick.
Oh, man.
And he could turn those qualities on and off as suited the situation. And of course, his work for Hewitt here in this gallery picture is, he's like telling you funny stories.
Yes.
That have a creepy overtone.
He sells it. He sells it even when there's really nothing to sell.
Oh yeah, he was a great storyteller. First time I met him, I was with my father in New Mexico on a business trip. He had branch companies all throughout the Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in a restaurant and talking about favorite movies, and topic of John Carradine came up, you know, and Dad said, "Well, yes, and for my money, the best Carradine is Grapes of Wrath, you know, Preacher Casey and all that." And I was thinking, "Well, yeah, I, I liked him in Face of Marble and My Father Cringes, you know. But he says, I can almost hear that booming voice right now. And all of a sudden, we heard that voice.
Oh, my gosh.
Turned around, is like, oh, my gosh, it's John Carradine ordering a chicken fried steak dinner. and just shamelessly flirting with the waitress.
Right.
And a little short orders, Town Square Cafe. And well, I'm going to go over there and see if that's really him. It's like, well, you know, what's the worst? He can tell you to buzz off. Sure. He didn't. He's like, oh, you fellows join me. You know?
Oh, how nice.
and he, of course, proved himself a great spontaneous storyteller. He determined really quick that I liked the spookers. And he said, well, my boy, I'll tell you a picture I'm just about to start into production on. And he describes this horrifying ghost story about a living dead man with a grudge against the entire human race. And I, well, gosh, Mr. Carradine, what's the name of this movie? He says, we're going to call it The Gripes of Wraith. So zing again, you know, and of course what he was really getting ready to go back to Hollywood to work on was The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Oh.
Where he not only appears in a crucial incidental part, but he also walks away with the show. So wait a minute, I thought this was a John Wayne picture. No,
right.
All of a sudden, it's a John Carradine picture.
Well, you know, I met him, and I don't think we've talked about this on the podcast. I met him on his penultimate picture, which was called Revenge, was shot in Tulsa.
Mm-hmm.
And you know this story, but perhaps the listeners, there are listeners that don't. Lord knows I've told this story enough in my life, but I was covering it for both Fangoria and the Tulsa World. I was working for the Tulsa World, but a lot of times things like this would come up and I could do double duty because I was writing for Fangoria very steadily at that time. This would be the late 80s.
Yeah.
And at the time, he was estranged from his boys. And he was under the care, I suppose, of a guy named Byron, who was a man that I met out on the set, and a terrible birth defect with his hands and his feet turned inside out. You know, so he would have a very curious way of walking. But Byron and I were talking about John Carradine, and we were sitting out on the set, and this was outdoors. So they're shooting this near Okmulgee, Oklahoma. And it's being shot by a pond. And Christopher Lewis, who was the director, they'd set up a little, this was a made direct-to-video, although by this time they were shooting on 16mm. This was the third that United Entertainment and Christopher and Linda Lewis had done together following Blood Cult and The Ripper. So they've got this little, it's about a dog-worshipping cult from Tulsa, the Cult of Caninus. And they've got a little altar down by this pond. And you know how film sets are. And there's little groups of people. There's a little craft services group over here, a little makeup group over here. And they're all kind of around with their lights on. And so I'm sitting up there talking to Byron. And this extended cab pickup pulls up on the hill behind us. A couple people run out and put boxes down. And then they let this incredibly slight little figure, I don't know, he was deep in his 80s by this point, and take him gingerly down, and a couple of people standing beside him as he walks past me, and he just looks like, well, he always, you know, he's called half a profile in Golden Age Hollywood, and he just looks like somebody's just desiccated old grandpa, and it's one of those, I start thinking about the cliche about how awful it is to sometimes to meet your heroes, because he was a hero of mine. And he walks by, and Byron's telling me about him and all of this, and his hands, of course, are twisted with arthritis, twisted completely back toward the wrist, fingers pointing toward the wrist. And so he gets down to the altar, and there's another actor there, Joseph Hart, who's playing his second in command, Tulsa TV personality. And Christopher's slips on, or somebody slips on this robe on John with a big dog, you know, emblem in the front. And so Christopher says, John says, would you like to rehearse it? And Carradine sort of nods. Well, by this point, Carradine could not remember lines, so they had all of his dialogue written on poster board.
Sure.
Right beside the camera. so he could look and see it. Jim Vance, our friend James Vance, the the writer of Kings in Disguise and On the Ropes and so much good graphic novel stuff, had written this soliloquy for Carradine. And so I'm just sitting there thinking, gosh, he just looks so awful. Well, he looks like he's half asleep. He doesn't. And so Chris says, all right, John, you ready? And he sort of nods. And so Chris says, all right, action, steps back, and Carradine draws himself up. And he says, I have come from out of the ether. And it's that same voice I remembered from Shock Theater in 1957, 1958.
Oh,
I was 9 years old. And he's declaiming, and everybody around that set just stops what they're doing, and everybody is walking toward him as he's doing this fairly lengthy soliloquy.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time he's about to finish, there's a semicircle around him just listening to him declaim. And at the end of it, he just drops his hands and his head, and the whole place erupted into applause.
Oh, yeah.
And it was one of the greatest moments in certainly my covering this sort of thing. And then later on, I got to talk to him. And by that time, he didn't remember a lot. This was right before he went to South Africa to do Buried Alive with Robert Vaughn.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And then he came back. I knew a woman on the Karen Witter, who was on that film, and she said by the time he got to South Africa, he couldn't even read the cue card, I mean the poster board, and people would whisper his lines to him before he started.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
He was coming back and going through Italy, you know, and he was climbing some stairs to see some artwork or another, and that's when he died.
Yeah, I watched him do that same summoning the inner demon on that cameo he did in Peggy Sue Got Married.
Yes.
And and it was like, and Chris Francis Coppola was just in awe.
Mm-hmm.
It was like he didn't even have to direct. The minute the director calls action, the great artist appears.
And he, every time. That's exactly right. Well, somebody else that's in this that was not as well known as Lon Chaney or John Carradine was Rochelle Hudson. And Rochelle Hudson, I can speak about a little bit. I just wrote a column on her for Oklahoma Magazine. She was an ingenue from Oklahoma City, and she played in three Will Rogers movies I know of, starting in, I think, 33. I think it was Dr. Bull was her first one.
Yeah.
And Will Rogers from Claremore, Oklahoma, which is very close to where I'm speaking to you from, took a liking to her. Well, the publicist at 20th Century Fox, who had let her go on a contract, snapped her up and put her under contract again and decided that instead of Oklahoma City, they would make her from Claremore, just as Will Rogers was from Claremore.
Naturally.
Because Will Rogers, of course, people don't really remember, he was the biggest movie star in the world in 1934.
He was the first superstar.
He was the first superstar.
Perhaps with Caruso in yes. that league.
Yeah, he was exactly in that league. So, you know, they kept that little fallacy up. Well, she was in New York, and she's only 18 or 19 years old and not really used to a lot of publicity. And the New York people start asking, well, tell us about your hometown. And in a moment of either guilelessness or pique, Rochelle Hudson says, Claremore? Claremore stinks. Well,
a reference to the mineral waters.
To the mineral waters, which was Claremore's biggest, next to Will Rogers, Claremore's biggest claim to fame. People would go there for the mineral baths to take care of various ailments. And that's what she was talking about, allegedly. Well, women's groups threatened to boycott her films. 20th Century Fox just went haywire, pulled her back from New York. Anyway, she had several little comebacks. She had a little comeback in The Night Walker, which we talked about here a few movies ago.
Yes, of course.
You know, she played second string character to Barbara Stanwyck. At the time, she also said, Claremore still stinks. But this was her last picture, and she looks quite old. She's in the, the fourth one, I guess, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like she was only in her 50s.
She was only just about 50. Yeah, because she died at 55.
Crazy.
And seeing her in there brings to mind something my friend Clue Gulager told me one time. He, of course, spent some time here in Oklahoma, too, later in life. And he said, you know, if you're going to want to continue to act in movies as you grow older, you're going to have to make horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly he and his wife, Miriam, made some great horror movies. But there is Rachel Hudson, obviously in there for name value, but you wonder how much name value Rachel Hudson had at that point in 68 or 67, whatever it was.
Name value is what you make of it, and for a small change production like this one, she was a big name.
Yeah. Right.
But you know, I mean, Rochelle Hudson. My gosh, what a fascinating career. She's Peter Lorre's bird in a gilded cage in the Island of Doomed Men.
Best movie I've seen her in is Island of Doomed Men.
Piece what of work, and not just because it's a good old Columbia B picture, but because it's like a ferocious, virile exercise in sadism and its consequences.
And buried sexuality, too.
Very tense. Yeah. It looked almost, in that respect, like a Paramount of the general period. Mm-hmm. She was the sweetheart in Harold Teen, based on the comic strip.
That's right.
And what a lot of people are invariably surprised to find out that in the Warner Brothers Bosco cartoons of the early 30s, she was the voice of Bosco's girlfriend.
She was Bosco's girlfriend. She was only, what, like 15 or 16 at that time? Yeah, yeah. She had a terrific, I mean, she had a very good beat. She was one of those people that was always a major studio B-picture star.
Yeah.
And she's never looked better than in Island of Doomed Men. I watched that just recently, and that is you're right, ferocious is a good way. It's a smoldering little picture, too.
Oh, man.
And in its way, don't you think, I mean, I think it's very apt to compare it to Paramount, because in its way, it's like the Panther Girl and Charles Laughton's relationship in Island of Lost Souls.
Island of Lost Souls, yes, very much so. And of course, she was versatile. I mean, she didn't. Yeah. She did comedy. She did musicals. She did. She supported Shirley Temple at one point.
She sure did.
And just
this
an
was
amazing.
Her last movie. This was it. This
and
was
what?
This was her epitaph.
What a ghastly exit! But so, and it's like, aren't you glad she made it?
Yes. Yes.
that's the thing, because. It's like, George Turner and I once asked Boris Karloff, why are you doing these horrible, cheapskate Mexican horror movies?
For
Jack Hill, yeah, yeah. Who shot the U.S. footage. Mm-hmm. His health was so bad that his doctor wouldn't let him go to Mexico, so they sent a unit to Hollywood. And George and I did this career interview with Karloff for the American Film Institute right at this time. And it's like, well, why? What are you doing? Karloff says, I want to die in harness.
Which is just pretty much what Clue Gulager said when I asked him about some of his pictures. He says, John, actors act.
Yeah.
It's the very same thing. Well, what would you, we're going all around the movie itself to talk about these wonderful people who are in it. What would you say to sum up your opinion, your feelings about Dr. Terror's Gallery of Horrors?
It's really more a document of a place and a time than anything else. I think anyone who approaches the film expecting something on a par with the Amicus anthology films is going to be really disappointed. Not that the stories are so bad, and in fact, there's an obvious attempt to be like O. Henry.
Absolutely.
And surprise you. Mm-hmm. The production values are shabby. The actors deserve better. It's not as though they act as though they did deserve better, because they're given what they've got.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a nice surprise, apart from any attempted narrative surprises, just to see these players at a stage in life where they really could have been perhaps been choosier.
Yeah.
I saw Chaney on the Johnny Carson show about this same time,
uh-huh.
not long before he died.
I did too.
And he was in control, except he was losing his voice.
Mm-hmm. Throat cancer at that time.
Yes.
Like he's
yes.
dead, yeah.
Yeah. And he told a very funny story to Johnny Carson about his voice. I was doing my Wolfman howl for some kids at Halloween, and I threw my voice box out of whack.
I remember that. I saw that very same episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so excited to see Lon Chaney on it. He did, as I recall, it seemed like he might have tippled a couple before he went out.
Well, yeah, I mean, that kind of comes with the territory when you're Lon Chaney Jr.
Well, it kind of comes with the territory in those days. I remember the great George Gobel line. We talked about this when George Gobel was backstage, and he was throwing down a couple in the green room, and Johnny Carson came by to say hi, and George said, "Hello, Johnny." He said, "Would you like a drink?" And Johnny Carson said, oh, no, he says, "I never drink before I go out and do the show." Gobel looks at him and says, "You mean you go out there by yourself?"
Ooh, yeah.
I know. Yeah, and so I think that was maybe even the rule rather than the exception sometimes in those days, in the late 60s and late 60s, early 70s when all of that was going on. And I thought Lon Chaney, I remember seeing Lon Chaney, I remember seeing Leo Gorcy on Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them, I really wanted them to do well because they were people that I had vested interest in that were not particularly mainstream at that point.
Sure.
And they both seemed to me to be just a little tipsy.
Well, that's something that one must accept as a condition of the personality. If it hadn't been for that trait, you wouldn't have had such performances.
That's exactly right.
And that's like, gosh, what a terrible sacrifice for one's art, and yet I doubt they knew any other way.
I think you're absolutely right. Would you recommend this picture then to our listeners?
Well, you know, I mean, it's it's free online.
That's
what have you got
Joey
to lose?
Our producer Joey just handed me a late breaking bulletin here. The movie is up for free on YouTube, and we will link to it on our Facebook group.
Of course.
So there you go. All right. And, I don't know. It's one of the most inept pictures I've seen in quite some time. But it's not mean-spirited in any way. And to me, that gives it a little bit of an extra buoyancy.
No, it looks like the sets are about to fall apart. And, in fact, I believe one did at one point and caused a bit of damage, according to an anecdote that circulates. And, it's like that Tales of Tomorrow episode Chaney did doing the Frankenstein monster,
yes,
where
yes.
you can see the walls shaking.
Yes. You know, this is Chaney, who is apparently so hammered that he thinks they're on a rehearsal, and when he knocks over a chair accidentally, he sets it back up. As the monster. The thing that you're talking about, I believe I took some notes on this, was the director of photography was struck on the head by a piece of falling board on the set.
Ah, okay, that's the one.
Unconscious, yeah. And but you know the show must go on, and what a show it is.
Amazing.
Well, Michael, I want to find out in our last few minutes what do we have to plug here. I've got a couple of things. How about yourself?
Well, we've got
Forgotten Horrors 7 coming along.
Forgotten Horrors Volume 7 is in the indexing stage right now.
Yeah.
I've got to get my IT guy into the studio tomorrow and check out a problem with our book building software. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, I'm cranking away on the index, and we're just about finished.
I really like what I've read. Of course, I've proofread it. because you've been nice enough to once again make me a little part of it. And it's a wonderful volume. I'm very excited to be in it and doing my little Susan Gordon thing.
Your insights on the Burt I. Gordon empire are are irreplaceable. First generation research is hard to come by.
It's getting harder all the time, too.
And there really are no, you know, Dave Hickey, the great critic from New Mexico, well, Texas actually, but he lives in Santa Fe, says there probably aren't more than 25 working critics, credentialed critics in the business today.
Are you serious?
He's serious, and Hickey and I used to work together in the newspaper business, and he sensed the writing on the wall as early as 1984. So, like, this newspaper business is being overwhelmed by celebrity gossip and nonsense like that, and he got out. I mean, it's of course it's the critics who open the door for the artists.
Yes,
it's the professors who, in an ideal world, preserve the knowledge. They're not really compatible spirits.
No, they're not.
But you know, I mean, with Hickey says with art with critics is a carnival of possibilities. Art with professors, as opposed to critics, is a monastery. And art without critics or professors is Hobby Lobby.
That's why these
primary source insights, you know, not just documenting what happened, but putting it into a historical context, like you've done with the Burt Gordon family. That's why these things become more and more valuable.
Well, and that's why I love, for instance, and people will ask me about the Forgotten Horror stuff, and you know, I have a very, very soft spot for all of them, but especially to the nth degree, and the piece that you did on Larry Buchanan, I still think is just the as long as we're in a mutual admiration society, but we really are, it is just something that I would point to as the way that it should be. This is the way that these things should be. There's criticism, but there's also, as you say, primary source. You knew Larry Buchanan. You talked to Larry Buchanan. You have insights I don't know if anybody else has ever had.
Well, Larry himself published an autobiography, and it's quite good. And the pieces that we did together, newspaper pieces and then the chapter in the book, dovetail so ideally with his autobiography that it's like, okay, the story is told. Now, appreciate it.
Well, we recommend that you take a look at The Forgotten Horrors online or other places. It's in other places. Michael, where are The Forgotten Horrors besides Amazon.com?
The main outlet besides Amazon is oldies.com.
Oldies.com, all right.
Ideally, I've got to lay in an inventory for our forthcoming literary festival in Fort Worth, but generally speaking, you know, there are no bookstores anymore.
Right. Amazon is the bookstore. Yeah, it is the biggest bookstore. Yeah. Now, what about your comics from the Gone World? What's going on with those?
Working on a brand new. In fact, I just posted a new painting this morning on our Forgotten Horrors Facebook podcast Facebook page. A bit of a parody piece. The Gone World Project, of course, manipulates existing comic books of a certain vintage and replaces the trite and fatuous dialogue of the originals with stuff that's like 10 times more trite and fatuous.
Basically, it's existentialism paired with cops eating donuts.
Cops eating donuts. Yes, a lot of donuts.
A lot of cops and donuts, and a lot of tag lines, a lot of in jokes, and they're I love them.
You know, corny old borscht belt humor.
That's right, and also a lot of existentialism as well.
A lot of people
don't know that that you helped us, John McMahon and myself at Reverse Karma Press, that you were the person that was responsible for getting us on Amazon and building the book and really making the book look better after we had published it ourselves.
Oh, hard-boiled Christmas stories.
Hard-boiled Christmas stories I'm talking about. We got it up in time for Christmas, and sales were international. We had European sales, we had British sales, we had American sales. And it's because you were able to turn that around and help us out. And so if anybody, it's hard-boiled Christmas stories, but you know, you can just read it any time of the year. And it'll give you that warm feeling.
Not just for Santa Claus anymore.
Not just for Santa Claus anymore. Well, Michael, we'll get back together again soon with another topic. And again, we want to thank the folks for listening. And if they want to suggest, if anyone wants to suggest a film they'd like for us to work on, we'll do that. All they have to do is contact us where is it, Joey?
The Facebook group.
The Forgotten Horrors Facebook group, Forgotten Horrors Podcast. It's free, and if you like it and want to show your appreciation, then we've got lots of Forgotten Horrors titles online. All right, Michael, we'll be yakking at you soon.
Back with you.